content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach on A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And last time, we left off at the chapter on conception for January and February, things to do. And we will return to this part. This first portion is journals, writing it all down. In recent years, prodded by my sister, a writing teacher, I offered a class online that I called Garden Writing for Everyone. I told prospective students, gardening and writing are the two interwoven threads that have shaped my adult life. I cannot imagine being without either. Each is far more than a mere career component, but more of a life practice. I heartily recommend digging into both, even if simply for your own sanity and joy, or at the simplest level, for record keeping in the privacy of a garden journal and not for publication. I encourage each of us to give voice in at least the most basic way to what comes up, whether tulips or a sense of intimate correct connectedness when we head outside. Why take the time to write it all down? When I write something down, it really sinks in, aiding memory, with all the layers that the garden has to offer, not just that what blooms when, notations that might inspire future plant combinations if one was eventually transplanted beside the other, but also the slightly more woo-woo stuff that's really valuable, like the catalogs your garden journal offers, free gardening lessons gleaned from your own adventures, and sometime something else no other publication will. Highly localized cultural information, geared precisely to this spot. Here is where we learn what is and is not possible, if only we write it down and pay attention. When I began gardening, a sturdy notebook was the standard issue, but a computer is a fine place to store garden records too, though far less romantic. It will never become dog-eared by muddy fingers or grow too wide to close because of all the flowers and leaves pressed inside. If you prefer the digital medium, there are apps for garden journaling, or start a blog with one of the free programs such as WordPress.com and journal there. What's critical is to create an information storage system and use it, and again, hopefully also make it a repository of observations that are a bit more on the inspirational side. And I have to put a side note here is that my journaling is helping a great deal because with my first garden this year, I put too many tomato plants too close together and a lot of squash plants that did not work because of the fungus that it got. So I have next year, I have those notes to go back to. And it continues here with most important to record are bloom dates, start and finish, to identify what plants might make good partners. Planting dates and the precise names will be helpful. Note where you got each plant. Print and save order confirmation emails to post or copy into your notebook. And record where each permanent one was placed. This latter detail will be especially helpful when you find yet another label in the middle of the lawn or in the compost heap and have to try to figure out which epimedium or daffodil it belonged to. I record sightings of bird comings and goings in the citizen science database, ebird.org, like an online checklist, a project of Cornell Lab of Ornithology and Audubon. For those wishing to contribute other natural history data, the Nature's Notebook program of the USA National Phenology Network would be happy to have you, and you'll become a sharper observer by observing and recording the time of planting and animal phenophases. The switch between phases, such as from dormant buds to bud break to flowering to seeding, setting seed. In my earliest journal, I had a page each month for self-criticism of a sort, a multi-column list whose categories simply read rescue, remove, and ugh. The plants under the first heading are judged as worthy ones, but deserve a better home than I had given them. They're getting too much or too little light, moisture, space. The remove list is not so clear. Will I dig it out and compost it or find the plant a new home in my yard or someone else's? The UGG list is obvious. One problem, you'll get so swept up in sowing and weeding and edging and dividing, hopefully, that you'll forget. Promise to at least take pictures weekly all year. Organize them by date in a computer or cloud photo management program, or even just post them to Instagram. Whatever it takes so that you can see the evolution by scrolling or swiping through and be reminded what happened when in your corner of the world. And our next topic is zones and other considerations. And I just want to remark here is that if you are in North Carolina, like I am doing this program, we have the westmost coast, the west coast of North Carolina is zone 6. The Appalachia area is a 7. Piedmont or Raleigh, where I am right now, is a zone 8. And the coast around along Wilmington is a 9. Half the nation's 80 million or so gardeners found themselves officially declared a half zone warmer in January 2012 when the U.S. Department of Agriculture updated its plant hardiness zone map for the first time since 1990. No, the new map was not technically a confirmation of a trend towards global warming. A different data set is used than in those longer-range calculations, but simply a more accurate picture of America's growing conditions. Ever more sophisticated, computers enabled the sharper take, particularly in tricky mountainous areas or those near bodies of water, which can cause sharp variations despite close adjacencies. In 2012, MAP draws on data from 1976 to 2005, specifically 30-year averages of what are essentially extreme events, minimum winter temperatures. Climatologists studying climate change by comparison look for trends in overall average temperatures over a 50 to 100-year period. I was one of the 50% who changed zones to 5B from 5A, which means my zone gets down to about minus 10 to minus 15 degrees Fahrenheit. Each full zone is 10 degree Fahrenheit winter minimum. However, I feel like I am in zone all bets are off lately, as I suspect others also do, with ever more unexpected weather patterns. Nursery plants and catalog listings are typically marked with a USDA hardiness range, but there is a limit to how much you can rely on that alone to determine what you can and cannot grow, and to what degree of perfection, or at least satisfaction. Use the numbers as a guideline, but then let the garden tell you instead. I'm not recklessly leaving any Zone 8 or 10 rated plants outdoors in winter, but I've been growing many supposedly Zone 6 plants even before my zone was officially 5B, and have killed plenty of Zone 4 or 5 plants. Winter low temperature is just one factor. Place a bone-hardy plant in a poorly draining spot so that it is effectively standing in an icy sump, and you will kill it. A plant deprived of adequate soil moisture leading up to winter is also ill-prepared for coming through the cold weather well. Don't confuse such havoc with lack of hardiness. Moisture of another kind is the form of in the form of humidity can be a blessing or a curse. In winter, high relative humidity means less moisture is lost from foliage, dormant buds, and even twigs, minimizing damage as the temperature drops. But a low humidity wintertime blast, perhaps accompanied by wind, will be tough going, especially for conifers and broadleaf evergreens, rhododendrons, for instance, or mountain laurel, boxwood, or holly, maybe causing desiccation and even dieback. Other events, elements in the hardiness equation may include the duration of extreme cold spells, momentary or tenacious, and whether there is insulating snow cover. How long ago the plant was installed and how well rooted in it is can make a difference. Repeated dramatic freeze-thaws can be a major killer of newly planted things. Whatever is said on the nursery label, even the hardiest will die if heaved from the ground. Another one I'm attributing more damage and losses in woody plants to lately, with the unhinged new normal of the seasons. Whether the plant had a chance to properly harden off the previous fall, ideally, the fall season is gradual cooling down phase, plant slow gradually towards dormancy as days shorten and temperatures drop. If the first deep freeze comes very early or the fall is exceptionally warm, it may catch those plants unprepared and render some tissue vulnerable. Fertilizing after about July here or when pruning too late can also have been the culprit by causing the plant to send up succulent new growth that wasn't stress ready. Though a relief to us, sunny late winter days can bring havoc. Imagine standing out there in the bright sun all day, particularly on the south side of a building with the extra reflected heat that warms your tissues, and then, when darkness falls, having the temperature plummet. leaves like a broadleaf evergreens are most susceptible, since they may heat up to 10 or 20 degrees higher than the rest of the plant. Then feel the drop at night, the worst of all. This is also when overwintered flower buds that are just starting to swell, ones on mophead or Macrophylla hydrangea, for instance, and the earliest blooming magnolias, literally get nipped in the bud, and the gardener assumes the plant isn't hardy, or at least its flowers aren't. Wrong. Or at least maybe wrong. Buds on plants sited on the southern side of a building are especially vulnerable to being awakened a little too early, then killed if a late frost follows unseasonably warm weather. It's great to have the first magnolia on the block to bloom, which the protected locations yield. But in volatile years, you may have no flowers at all. The same plant on the north or east side, out of intense direct sun, would stay asleep a little longer, perhaps until the weather settled, and might miss the roller coaster. My basic approach to zones is educate yourself. But then never fear trying a plant that's one zone less hardy than your location. Don't buy 20 of something marginal as a test, but do try a couple, preferably in different locations. Try again a second year, and if you fail twice but still covet the plant, pot one up and enjoy it that way. And our next title is Taxonomy Light. It all sounds like Plantus unknowninensis at the start, but botanical Latin is the mother tongue of gardening and must be reckoned with. Besides being the only precise way of asking for what you want, it's often actually quite informative. Once you get the hang of it. The genus name, which comes first, is expressed as Latin in an italicized word starting with an uppercase letter. A genus is a group of related species, such as Helianthus, the sunflowers. The plural of genus is a surprise. Genera, not genuses. It is not always obvious what the genus name derives from unless you speak Latin, know the history of botanical exploration, or possess some other equally arcane skills. Many genera are named for the explorer who discovered them. Davidia, for instance, after Pear David, or someone they were meant to honor, Franklina for Ben Franklin, or Dahlia for a botanist called Dahl. Others are simply Latin words for what they look like. Aster means star. The species name or specific epithet, which follows the genus to form each two-part name or Latin binomial, is lowercase and expressed in italics. A species is a group of individuals that are closely enough related to interbreed. Two distinct species in the same genus typically won't, with exceptions. Often, the species name tells us something extra about the plant's background or appearance. Some species names reflect their discoverer. Magnolia wilsoni, after English plant collector E.H. Wilson, or Prunus Sargenti for Charles Sargent, first director of the Arnold Arboretum. Or they might reveal the person they were meant to honor, physician and botanist George Engelman, instrumental in identifying native plants of Western North America, had a native spruce, pink oak, and even a prickly pear cactus named for him with the specific epithet Engelmanii. The plant's place of origin can also be invoked. Some that come up again and again include Virginiana, or Virginia, or the area roughly equivalent to the early colonies, or Occidentalis, which is Western, or Japonica, which is Japan. The physical appearance is another common possibility. Argentia, which is silver, aurea, which is gold, and lanata, which is fuzzy, and nana, which is dwarf, are common examples. Some are easier than others and even hint at their English translations, like prostratus or horizontalis, for growing horizontally, or columnaris for another growth habit altogether, and deciduous or variegata for variegated. But don't get too excited. I'm afraid memorization is the key. A third word is sometimes used to identify a cultivar, short for cultivated variety. This version of the plant, usually an asexual propagated one or clone, is known only in cultivation and was selected out of the average population of the strait species for some unusual feature. It might have variegated leaves or different colored or double flowers, or a weeping habit. This third word is usually expressed in English, Roman letters, inside single quotes, and begins with an uppercase letter, as in Pinus strobus, pendula, a semi-dwarf eastern white pine cultivar with weeping trailing branches. There is always more to learn. A disheartening fact is that even for those who have been memorized plant names for years, things change. Taxonomists are insistent on getting everything just right, down to the last chromosome, and keep re-examining plants under higher-powered microscopes or other methods, pollen granule by pollen granule, and regrouping them. Some familiar garden coleuses, for example, were for a moment no longer Coleus blumei, but Solenostemon scoteri. Let me try that one again. I have just as much trouble here. Scotellarioides. When they become Plectranthus scotellariodes. Perhaps the biggest shock of all was when chrysanthemum ceased to be what we knew it as. Dendranthema and other genera became the new homes to the chrysanthemum's former members for a while. Then the common florist types and some others got switched back again in 1999. If you were hooked on their shorthand common name during that chaotic time, sorry, because mum wasn't the word. Well, at least, not for a moment or two. the place to get the latest lowdown on who goes where in the ICNCP, or International Code for the Nomenclature of Cultivated Plants, typically the latest edition is not available to the public online. However, so instead I searched the plant list, theplantlist.org, a collaboration between esteemed botanical organizations, including the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew, Missouri, Botanical Garden, New York Botanical Garden, and the Royal Botanical Garden in Edinburgh. The Encyclopedia of Life, EOL.org, also includes taxonomic notes for many plant entries, sometimes with a bit of the history of past name changes. I think it's important to know the correct nomenclature, but as a gardener, being ever so precise can have its limitations. In catalogs, reference books, and certainly in the aisles at the garden center, the renamed plants will probably still be where they were and are likely to stay put for years. I didn't ask for a flat of Solanostemon during that temporary uprising, and even now I don't ask for Plectranthus, which would likely have me directed to the robust and more sideways growing ones I like to use as trailers in my biggest summer pot designs, like silvery P. argentatus. I stuck with coleus. Say what, speak Latin. The worst part of basic botanical Latin is worries about proper pronunciation. I only wish that someone had told me 20 years earlier that my pronunciation was fine and light years better than imprecise common names. Botanical Latin, it turns out, isn't a real spoken language at all, not the mother tongue of ancient Rome, but a system of nomenclature or naming invented by Carl von Linn, also known as Linnaeus, in 1753. How do you pronounce the words of a language that doesn't belong to any one nation or people exactly? Any way you like, I think. And I have that on good authority. The preeminent botanist William T. Stern, in his classic 1966 manual Botanical Latin, gave us the okay when he wrote, "Botanical Latin is essentially a language, written language, but the scientific names of plants often occur in speech. How they are pronounced really matters little, provided they sound pleasant and are understood by all." We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.